It's nice. I thought I'd talk about a very important issue for all meditators, which is how to balance energy. Called tonight's talk, Uses and Abuses of Mental Energy. And I'd like to start with a very well-known illustration from the Pali Canon. The Venerable Sona, before he ordained as a monk, was a very proficient musician. However, after he had ordained, he wanted to attain liberation, and he worked extraordinarily hard at trying to become enlightened. So hard, in actual fact, that the practice became very, very painful. Apparently the commentaries to this particular story say that he had a walking meditation path, and he was trying so hard that there was actually blood from his feet on the path. By his own admission, he was one of the Buddha's most energetic students, but his mind had not yet attained liberation, and his attitude changed. He became depressed, and he considered giving up the practice and returning to lay life. The Buddha, understanding his distress and its cause, out of compassion, went to him and tried to help him through this. He asked him, "When you were in lay life, were you skilled at playing the lute?" And indeed, the Venerable Sona indeed was very skilled at playing the lute. The Buddha asked, "When the strings were tightened, when they were taut, was the lute well tuned and easy to play?" And Sona replied, "Well, no, it wasn't easy to play at all." "If the strings were too lax, was the lute well tuned and easy to play?" "No, he couldn't play it at all." "However, if the strings of the lute were neither too taut nor too lax, was it then well tuned and easy to play?" "Why, yes, it was indeed." The Buddha said that if energy is applied too forcefully, it leads to restlessness. If energy is too lax, it will lead to lassitude. "Therefore, Sona," said the Buddha, "keep your energy in balance. Penetrate to a balance of the spiritual faculties, and there seize your object." And in due course, Venerable Sona reapplied himself to his meditation, found the correct level of energy, and in due course, of course, attained enlightenment. So balancing energy is an incredibly important part of the Buddha's teaching. In fact, there's a collection of mental factors which are known in Buddhism as the 37 requisites of enlightenment. Energy is mentioned 9 times. That's more than any other mental factor, including mindfulness. So clearly the Buddha felt that understanding energy, understanding how to use it and to stop abusing it, was a very important issue. And really the theme of tonight's talk is very simple. Life has a very natural flow. If we can learn what the correct level of energy to apply, not going for the minimum, not going for the maximum, but reaching the optimum level of energy, then we can respond to all life's challenges in daily life and in meditation and remain in the moment, remain open, happy, creative, relaxed, yet attentive. However, an abuse of energy, getting it wrong, can be very detrimental to physical and mental well-being. So that's why we need to understand about energy. What is energy? Looking up in the philosophical texts, I found a very simple definition for energy. It is simply that mental factor that supports one's chosen endeavour, regardless of what that endeavour is. It just supports it. Another way to put it is that it prevents the collapse of your chosen endeavour. So just like new timbers on an old house, or help keep the house up, or army reinforcements will help the king defeat the enemy. That's what energy is. Another important aspect to remember about energy is that energy is ethically variable. That's what it says in the text. Basically, what that means is it itself is neither right nor wrong. It's not the energy that is right or wrong or wholesome or unwholesome. There are other factors that tend to give the moral colour or flavour to one's endeavour. How do we understand right and wrong then, if it's not the energy itself? Quite simply, in Buddhism we define right or wrong by the kind of result that the endeavour produces. So that means that if the endeavour produces fatigue and distress, then we can fairly safely assume that the energy was wrong. If, however, it doesn't do that, if it tends towards happiness, openness, a lack of a sense of separation, then we can be sure that the energy for that endeavour was right. To give you an example of this, imagine helping a friend move house. There are three possible responses. There may be a real reticence in helping them. They may be, you didn't even offer the help, but in the end they had to ask because you're the only one that could help in that situation. You go and help, but there's always this sense of, oh, wish I wasn't here. Wish I was doing something else. There's rugby league on the telly. I wish I was watching that. Something along those lines. Another way of applying yourself in that situation is to readily agree to help that person and then going and helping them and deciding to show them exactly how to move house properly. The tendency to take over, to control, to want to be in charge. That's another way of going about the same thing. There's a third approach, which is where you're simply happy to help your friend and you're willing to do whatever you're asked in that situation. The responses that you make are neither trying to get out of the situation or trying to control the situation, but rather there's just a gentle acceptance of doing whatever your friend wants you to do in order to help with the house move. Three different responses, but the energy in each case is the same because we went through the actual same process. We were helping our friend move. So it wasn't the energy that was important. It was the attitude behind it that made it right or wrong. A few examples of energy in daily life. Expenditure of wrong energy. Procrastination. There's a series of... Oh, I see some smiles already. You've got some paperwork that really ought to be done, but you don't do it. It's in the bottom of the drawer. And it doesn't get done this week, and it doesn't get done next week. You can always find something else to do. But all the time, it's there, sitting at the back of the mind. And actually, that's quite fatiguing and distressing, to always have that at the back of the mind. And quite a few people do suffer from procrastination. Another expenditure of wrong energy, going beyond the call of duty, again and again, being there for other people all the time, doing more than your fair share all the time. That's another wrong use of energy, and it has reasons and attitudes behind it, which hopefully will become more obvious later. Passionate responses, excitement and depression. Is life always really so exciting? Does it always have to be really, really exciting all the time? For some people, that can be quite a problem. And of course, there's the flip side, which is usually the same people then get very depressed and go, but is life ever really, really that bad? That can be another wrong use of energy. Obsessive preoccupations can send one's life out of balance. And again, it's just the energy is the supporting factor. All these kinds of wrong expenditure do lead to a sense of distress and fatigue. But expending right energy tends towards positive resultance, interest, enthusiasm, rejuvenation. For instance, there was a teacher who set up a meditation centre, but he had to work as well as running the meditation centre. So he was, overall, he was working very, very long hours, to the point where he said that he would go to sleep at night crying for exhaustion. And yet, he said, his energy was right. Physically, he was exhausted, but he was full of interest, enthusiasm, and his energy was perpetually being rejuvenated, to the point where he said, actually said, all that work actually improved his concentration. And the reason being that his energy was right, not wrong. He understood that life does have a natural flow. It has a spontaneity. And understanding this, he just went with what life was demanding at that time. Yes, physically he was tired, but mentally he was fresh as a daisy. What are the causes of wrong effort? Quite simply, craving, resisting the way life is. The procrastinator is resisting the way life is. The person going beyond the call of duty again and again is actually also resisting the way life is. When we crave, when we resist this, the flow of the natural flow of life, we're doing the impossible. We're forever caught in past, in future, and we're creating clinging attachment to certain ideas and values. The going beyond the call of duty person only feels that they're okay if they keep on going beyond the call of duty. If they simply do what is necessary, then they feel that they are open to blame. Somebody could find fault with them. And so in order to stop that from happening, they go again and again doing more than they have to. Do you see? So in actual fact, they are actually creating wrong energy for themselves, and there is resultant distress because you can't fix life in that kind of way. Just because somebody, they may actually get criticised for going beyond the call of duty. One interesting aspect of where there is craving, essentially doing the hindrances is what we're talking about here, is a relationship between mind and body. Physical fatigue can often be due to the mind. For example, if you see someone in a meditation who are doing sloth and torpor, their bodies can be at most extraordinary angles. And afterwards, somebody can feel extremely distressed, out of it, not with it at all. The mental factors that are present are causing a physical disturbance. Another example, recluses are human beings like everyone else, and from time to time we experience doubt. Should I be here? Should I be doing something else? If we allow doubt to run, that can have an extremely detrimental physical effect. I personally have experienced my legs feeling like lead, barely being able to move. Eventually, through establishing enough mindfulness, realising that it was due to doubt. It can really destroy you physically if you're perpetually running hindrances. Right effort is the middle way. Wrong effort is where we fall to extremes. So it could be the extreme of laxity or the extreme of over being overzealous, for instance. Recently, Alan was asked why finding the middle way was such a difficult task. And he replied that we have no perception of where the middle is. Our tendency is to go from one extreme to another, from that extreme back the other way. How do we find out where the middle way is? The only way is by walking the Noble Eightfold Path. The Buddha called the Noble Eightfold Path the middle way. It's the way between extremes that leads to the gradual elimination of suffering. One of the factors for the Noble Eightfold Path is right effort. If the causes of wrong effort are craving, what will bring about right effort? And here I'd just like to repeat what the Buddha had to say. And what, monks, is right effort? Here, monks, a monk generates desire for the non-arising of unarisen, unwholesome states. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind and strives. He generates desire for the abandoning of arisen, unwholesome states. He generates desire for the arising of unarisen, wholesome states. He generates desire for the continuation of arisen, wholesome states, for their non-decline, expansion and fulfillment. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind and strives. This is called right effort. Let me try to explain that a little bit for you with some practical examples. If somebody keeps the precepts impeccably, as a result, they do not experience guilty dreads. So by keeping the precepts, they ensure the non-arising of unarisen, unwholesome states. And I'm sure you'd agree that feeling guilty about past actions is a fairly unwholesome resultant. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind and strives. What about the abandoning of arisen unwholesome states? You have ill will in the mind and you simply rebalance it with thoughts of goodwill towards whatever object it is that you have in mind. Another person, for instance, just looking at their good qualities. In that way, we abandon unwholesome states. He generates a desire for the arising of unarisen, wholesome states. You can take that principle further and make loving-kindness practice a part of your life, your daily life. You'll find that, unbidden from time to time, the mind will be filled with the love and the joy of loving-kindness meditation. He generates desire for the continuation of arisen, wholesome states. Well, I'll go back to loving-kindness again. Once you've actually got loving-kindness going, it's as if a veil falls from the inner eye. You suddenly remember how delightful it is. It's at those times that you just keep the practice going, making much of it, as the Buddha says, for its non-decline, for its expansion and fulfillment by development. He makes an effort, he arouses energy, etc., etc. So it's really quite simple. What he's talking about here is rebalancing wrong effort with right effort. Now here I must go back to something that we mention rather a lot. The importance of mindfulness, labelling and wise reflection. How do you know whether you have an unwholesome state of mind or a wholesome state of mind? How can you effect right energy if you don't know what the state of your mind is? You need to be full of mind. We need to be full of mind. And we need to be able to label accurately what's going on in our experience and also to reflect wisely on it. And that's the essence of right energy. That's why right mindfulness is in the Noble Eightfold Path and right views. By developing right effort, There are so many benefits to it, but one I thought was worth mentioning was the flexibility it gives you. If you're craving life to be a certain way and not another way, take an example of you're very house proud and you believe that your house should never have a speck of dust. You've got people coming around and your place is a bit of a mess, but there isn't much time. Wrong energy will fall into worry, agitation, restlessness, and the consequent physical actions will be tension, hurry, with a likelihood of some ornament or other getting smashed. Right energy, however, has got this extraordinarily flexible quality to it, where it just responds to the needs of the situation rather than any underlying ideal. So it's a quick whip round with a duster, quick tidy up, because that's all I've got time for. And there's no fatigue involved or no distress involved, because you're simply responding to the needs of the situation rather than getting caught up in hindrances because of the situation, which are due to a certain amount of idealism. All right, so there's some ideas about wrong and right effort in the daily round. What I'd like to talk about now is balancing energy in the meditation. Somebody asked me recently why it was that sitting in a chair, closing your eyes and watching the rise and fall of the breath could make somebody wise. And really it's quite a simple answer. The value of concentrating on a single object shows us our mental patterns. It shows us our mental behaviour, our habits, our comfort zones, what we find easy and what we find difficult to do. Finding the middle is always difficult because we're always going against our conditioning. And as Alan said, we don't actually have a perception of where the middle is. So what we tend to do in the meditation is sometimes be lazy and sometimes be over-energetic. And we keep on flipping from one to the other and back from one to the other. When we're in a lazy pattern, meditation is too much trouble. It's difficult to hold the attention on the breath. As the Buddha said to Sona, seize your object. The lazy mind doesn't want to seize any object, thank you very much. It's comfortable just drifting, daydreamy, really doesn't want to summon up the requisite effort required. On the other hand, when we have an energetic pattern running, there is too much enthusiasm. There is a tendency to want results now. There's a lot of intention, a lot of volition involved in wanting to get somewhere with the practice. Such a person will seize their object. My goodness, will they seize their object? They will remain resolutely on the rise and fall of the breath, not allowing anything to interfere with that process. What tends to happen to them is that there's a lot of agitation, tension, and pain develop. You can often get pain actually in the abdomen or at the back of the head. So either we slide and slither into daydream and sleep, or the meditation gets restless, agitated, and very thinky. Solutions for the lazy mind. Remembering that we are going against our conditioning, because our conditioning just wants to stay in the comfort zone and it finds it very comfortable not working. Mindfulness. There has to be good labelling of what's going on in your experience. Note, being able to note boredom, disinterest, and the tendency to give up. What's then required is actually a restraint. It's the restraining the tendency to slip and slide. It's actually something we do. That's why it's housed in this talk on energy. We actually support the process of daydream and drifting. We might think that it's I'm not doing it, it's just happening. But actually, energy is being put in to that pursuit. One very good thing to help with the lazy mind is to arouse energy, to arouse enthusiasm, to put in intentions for the practice, to develop enthusiasm, to perhaps review the potential gains that can be had from meditation, reviewing past successes. One thing that's very helpful is to set the practice up properly. And by that I mean is actually taking the time out. You know, like a high jumper, before they jump, will review. They will actually go through the motions of what they're going to do before they actually take the jump. So organising the meditation beforehand. I'm going to do 15 minutes of loving kindness, and then I'm going to do loving kindness to this person, this person, this person, that person. Be quite pedantic about it. And when I've done that, then I'm going to do vipassana for the remaining time, and I'm going to be watching the three marks, etc., etc., etc. So you're like putting in the intentions. That's what I'm going to do. Because that's what the lazy mind needs. It needs an initial application. It needs an initial push just to get it, bring it out of its sleepiness. It needs to exert a little bit of energy. And interestingly, it's a bit like setting a boulder in motion. Once you've got the boulder moving, then all you have to do is just very lightly just keep it moving. Yeah, that's what the lazy mind needs, because once it's got going, it's happy. The mind's happy once it's got going. It's a bit like all those documents in the desk that you just can't be bothered to deal with now. Once you actually start dealing with them, it's not actually a problem. It was only the thought of doing it. It was only that initial push. And that's what the lazy mind needs. The energetic mind, the overzealous mind, needs good mindfulness too. What the over-energetic mind needs to do is to restrain the attempts to get somewhere with the meditation, to do something extra special to get the meditation going. Often we will give the meditator the instruction not to meditate, just to sit and do nothing. Now, when we've got this kind of pattern going, we feel comfortable when we take control, when we take the reins, when we feel like we're getting somewhere through our own volitions. And so it's very difficult for a person who's too energetic, because it will feel like you're being asked to do nothing, which runs completely against one's nature. And a lot of frustration can arise out of it. If someone persists in restraining that kind of thinking, of wanting to push, push, push all the time, and they just sit content in the moment, the mind will play very funny tricks. Perhaps a member of the family will be seen standing over them saying, "You've got to get on with something," or something along those lines. The Protestant work ethic, you've got to be seen to be doing something. It can take somebody a long, long time to get out of that habit. But eventually, if they do, they'll discover to their delight and their surprise that it's actually okay to do nothing. Well, what appears to be nothing is actually not nothing at all. It's just finding the right balance. It's finally accepting right energy. Both the lazy mind and the energetic mind, when they discover where right energy actually is, they love it. It's wonderful. They want to keep it there. But the trick with energy is it's a little bit like riding a bike. You always have to be prepared to make little adjustments. The mind will go lax. You need to inject a little energy. The mind will become a little agitated and a little restless. You need to rest. You need to hold back. Stop for a little while. That's why mindfulness, labelling, and wise reflection is so critical to success with the practice. There's some nice similes about learning to adapt the mind to suit the situation. One I love is imagining you've got a bird in your hand. And you don't want to be too tense because you'll squeeze the bird, but You also don't want to be too relaxed, because the bird will run free, will fly free. So you want to be neither too tense nor too relaxed when you're watching the breath in the meditation. You want to be neither too daring nor too timid. A little bit like pouring oil into a jar with a very thin neck. If you pour too quickly, it goes everywhere. But if you're too timid, none of the oil comes out. So the right energy is always the balance, it's the middle point. And often in our meditations, we go from one extreme to the other, and the middle is just there, but it's so unknown to us sometimes that we just go straight past it. But if you keep on meditating, gradually you will learn what I mean by this, what this balancing of the energy actually is. What's the best possible use of energy? What's the rightest of right energy? In my opinion, it's the pursuit of vipassana meditation. Developing this balance of the faculties, this balanced mind, in order to observe the three marks in all conditioned and conditioning phenomena. Doing so destroys the ignorance that creates the resistance that we experience when we're doing wrong energy. If we keep on witnessing conditionality, for instance, we experience that natural flow of life. If you think about all the conditions that are required for a tree to grow, you need sunshine, you need rain, you need fertilizer, etc., etc., etc. All those conditions have to be present. And there's an ongoing relationship between everything in that experience. So too with observing the five aggregates: materiality, feeling, perceptions, habitual tendencies, and consciousness. There is a perpetual dance of these conditioned and conditioning forces going on all the time. That's what life is, looked from the angle of ultimate experience. There is a natural flow. Everything works perfectly all the time. The problem is only ever when we resist. Wrong energy is when we resist. Right energy is when we accept and we learn to dance with the way life is, not wanting it to be another way. The secret to discovering right energy is simply to learn to restrain wrong energy. Rather than trying to find the middle, learn to stop going to the extremes. That's what vipassana will give you. And when the work is done, when the work of vipassana has been completely fulfilled, the enlightened mind always simply dances with life. It is always immersed in that natural flow. It doesn't resist. No matter what's going on, it's just responding in the most appropriate way. Now, it might not look like that from the outside, but the enlightened mind is just responding to the dance of life.